Welcome to Hunger for Wholeness, a podcast from the Center for Christogenesis. I'm your host, Robert Nicastro. Today, Ilya speaks with comparative religion scholar Patrick Beldio. In this first part of their conversation, they follow Patrick's Catholic background all the way to his experience in the Sufi community, unpacking how art and religion interact in life, work, and American society.
So, Patrick, Dr. Beldio, great to have you on our podcast, A Hunger for Wholeness. I have watched your trajectory over the years, and it's really a fascinating one. I thought maybe just by way of introduction, because many of our listeners may be the first time that they're being introduced to you. So maybe tell us a little bit about your journey and how did you get to where you are today?
Sure. I sort of patterned my journey after a dear mentor of mine, who as an undergraduate taught me theology, was Father John Dunn. He was both a theologian and a musician and a poet as well. And he wrote often about and taught often about how both paths were opened for him, but he chose the way of words over the way of music. But that later in his life, the way of music bent back towards his path and the two paths joined, and he was able to sort of weave them together.
Yeah.
I've been doing that my whole life with the visual arts and theology, I guess you could say, I guess broadly conceived. I got a degree as an undergraduate in the fine arts and sculpture. I also have a degree in philosophy. Then I went from there to study a master's in arts in systematic theology, Catholic theology. And that's where you and I met at the Washington Theological Union, and wrote even a master's thesis on how arts can be a form of postmodern theology. And John Dunn was important for that, as well as some David Tracy and other folks. And then I went on to study sculpture again at George Washington University and got a master's degree in fine arts. Though I had started that degree years before, after Notre Dame, I went to California to the Claremont Graduate School and had a very challenging year of trying to make art about what was important to me at that time, which was and still is sacred art, but in a contemporary way. It was Claremont Graduate School and a very postmodern place where Derrida, Foucault, and Kahn and so forth were really taught to us. And God was, you know, passé. And doing the human figure as I was doing in sculpture was also passé. So I left. That's why I left to go back to the East Coast. But I've been mining that year ever since. It was a very important year, even though it was very challenging to me. So in terms of the master's degrees, I got, you know, theology, then art. And then I taught for a while, sculpture and drawing and design and courses in the fine arts, and thought, gosh, I can't seem to get a job here, a permanent position. So I thought maybe getting a PhD would be helpful. In fact, I was encouraged by a teacher I had found in a Sufi tradition. And she encouraged me to get a PhD. And I sort of revolted against that. Being an artist, that felt like being an academic was not my path. But she saw something in that for me. And so after a few years of teaching and not getting anywhere with the job, I asked her, what do you think about me getting a PhD? She said, oh, yes, please apply. So I applied to Catholic University and completed a PhD in religion and culture. And that was wonderful. I was able to integrate the two paths of the visual arts and spiritual practice and theology. And I focused on, instead of Sufism, I asked my teacher, I said, what did you think about me maybe studying Sufism and the tradition that we're a part of here that I could talk about? She said, no, why don't you study Sri Aurobindo and the mother, because people know more about their work. And I was excited because I had also studied their work over the years. So that's what I did my dissertation on, was the Sri Aurobindo ashram. It's in southern India in Tamil Nadu. And I studied the ways in which they use the arts, both personally as spiritual figures and spiritual aspirants earlier in their life, but then how they became gurus and then used the arts as means of spiritual growth for their students as well. So I was studying that, yeah, I guess from the outside in, but also from the inside out as a practitioner who uses the arts, you know, as a means of spiritual growth. And at the same time, I was commissioned to make a large 40-foot tall sculpture for our Sufi community. That was the, I guess you could say, the expression of our ideal. And I was sort of making something I was writing about at the same time.
Let me just kind of focus in a little bit that, you know, you began your undergraduate at Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, nice Catholic university, that little place in the middle of America. And you were in a seminary for a short time there, I believe, right?
That's right.
So you were a very kind of Catholic world, and your artistry, your artist nature sort of opened up for you this trajectory, your interest in the arts. And so there's two things going on here that I just want to kind of maybe just kind of pull out those strands. One is your path from institutional Catholicism into and breaking into the Sufi community and the world of Hinduism and Hindu mysticism. That in itself is a really fascinating journey.
Right.
And the second is your combination of art as a means of spiritual growth. And I want to kind of explore those two things in more detail. So let's take that path first from institutional Catholicism into Sufism. And I want to say here, I do wonder as I listen to you, if your right brainness, you know, your open mind, you're not just open minded, your creativity. So creativity itself, you know, Whitehead would say creativity is the fundamental principle of reality. And I've always loved that because it means that boundaries are never fixed. You know, that boundaries are local, they're just permeable, and they can shift when the creative element becomes active enough to transcend into something more beautiful, more unified, this type thing. And I wonder, you know, if that creative principle has been active and alive in you ever since the beginning, even within the beauty of the Catholic tradition.
Indeed. Yeah, that's so beautiful. Yeah, I have a lot to say. I guess, you know, I was brought up, as you say, in a Catholic context, and Notre Dame was, and I grew up in Colorado, but then North Carolina, where it was the Bible Belt. And so being Catholic was really unusual. And so I was hungry for a Catholic education by the time I got to Notre Dame, because all of my friends were Pentecostal Baptists and so forth. And they were, they had a lot of negative understandings about the Catholic faith. And part of that was actually being against evolution or a teaching about evolution. And I was, you know, as a creative person, actually, it was obvious to me that evolution is true. You just have to, I mean, I guess you're talking about that creativity. That is the way I relate to the world. It is this boundary changing experience all the time. And actually, I need boundaries in order to channel that creativity. And so for me, the Catholic Church has always been a wonderful boundary, a wonderful sort of container to channel this chaotic ebullience of energy and force and creativity. And so I always found the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith to be such a nourishing thing. And so it was natural for me, I guess, to go to Notre Dame and feel very much at home, and even more so because it was my intellectual curiosity was tapped and my creativity. And I traveled to Italy and met I'm also Italian, and have Italian family there. So it was connecting with my Italian roots, Catholic roots, artistic roots in Italy. So all of that was the foundation. And my mother, my father, both of whom are musicians, we grew up singing, playing instruments for mass. And so we were kind of like the Von Trapp family out there, just singing and leading the congregation. And so I was used to, you know, using, I guess, creativity and arts as a means for spiritual growth, or just the way we practice our Catholicism. So Notre Dame became like a deep dive into all of that. And so priesthood seemed like an obvious next step for me. And the priests and brothers at Notre Dame were such, I had gained wonderful friendships with them. In fact, I just returned from a conference at St. Mary's College in South Bend. It was the International Thomas Merton Society that had a meeting. And there was some talk about you, and wonderful talks actually about your work and Thomas Merton. I went to one talk about that. And they announced, you'll be coming back to St. Mary's. And anyway, it was a wonderful return and sort of remembering of that time in my life, and how Thomas Merton actually was the first person to say the word Sufi in my memory. he was speaking to his brothers. And I heard this tape, I guess, that it was a recording that he had given a class on Sufism to his brother monks. And I was at Notre Dame when I heard this tape. And so bells seemed to just go off when I heard that word Sufi. I felt like, oh gosh, what is that? And I don't even remember what he said. I think what I recall him saying was, if anybody can define Sufism, they've already made a mistake. And I thought, okay, that sounds right. There's something to that. So one thing led to another. I met friends who were connected to the Sufi community that I ended up being a part of here in Washington, D.C. We have a center here. But it was really through reading books at first, you know, Thomas Merton, and then he really researched Sufism in the Islamic tradition and how that developed in the Middle East. The Sufi order that I became connected to is one that is called the Chistia order. Its roots are in Afghanistan and India, and then from India to the United States through a man named Hazrat Inayat Khan, who brought Sufism for the first time to the West in 1910.
Sure.
And so it was that community that I first learned about. And then 1952, long story short, another Indian named Meher Baba took this order over and called it Sufism Reoriented. He reoriented it to the United States of America, actually all of the Americas, to this land mass, and to him and his sort of new teaching, or you could say not really teaching. He was a silent teacher. He's actually silent for 44 years. But he reoriented it for the modern age. And the teachings are very compatible with, you know, the deep Catholic mysticism of Thomas Merton, the deep Vedantic mysticism of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. So I've been sort of bouncing between those three traditions, you could say, ever since.
In a pluralist world, it's not always obvious how to coherently integrate practices or ideas from diverse traditions. Next, Ilya asks Patrick more about his experiences of integrating Sufism with Western spirituality and how it relates to Christian mysticism.
I think a lot of people still don't know much about Sufism, but it sounds very much like a mystical tradition, first of all, and bearing a lot of resonances with Christian mysticism in some ways. And I know scholars have written on Teilhard de Chardin and Sri Aurobindo, for example. Beatrice Buteau wrote that book, Evolution Toward Divinity, on Teilhard and Sri Aurobindo. So let's talk a little bit about the mysticism of Sufism. I'm really fascinated by it. I always use a quote by Mansur al-Halaj. Is that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when he had this prayer and he says, you know, I think it's an encounter with the divine. And he says, who are you? And he says, your very self. You know, this idea, which I think is, you know, at the heart of Hindu spirituality, the Atman and the Brahman, the role of pure consciousness, the role of yoga, you know, or the disciplining of the body. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What does that mean in terms of an American version of this? Is that like going or something, or, you know, working
that's
out?
That's right. No, well, that's good. Meher Baba was very funny and fun often with his Western disciples versus his Eastern disciples. He was born in 1894. He died in 1969. And in the 1920s, he trained his Eastern disciples in India. And he began to train his Western disciples in the 1930s and sort of finished that work right before World War II. And he trained them very, in some ways, very similarly, but in other ways, very different. The Western persons, first of all, the women came forward as more kind of taking more responsibility versus the men in the East. I think that's mixed up today. But at the time, women sort of were drawn to him in a way that less men were, which was similar to Swami Vivekananda, who also gathered a lot of women. A wonderful book just came out about him about that. But anyway, his training was, well, one of the first retreats that he had with his Western disciples was in England. And one of his male devotees from England set up this silent retreat. And he had in his mind that he thought, well, Meher Baba would like to have a very silent retreat where we meditate all day, every day. And Meher Baba was not interested in this, but he let him go forward with And so they were in there meditating in some room. Meher Baba left at some point and they thought he was going to come back. But all of a sudden, someone felt, I'm going to get this story a little wrong, but someone felt some paper hit them in the face. And he looked over it, and it was Meher Baba blowing spitballs at the meditators.
Great.
He was making sort of fun of this idea that mysticism is to sit in a lotus position and become one with the Atman and one with Brahman through the Atman. And of course, that's what anybody ever, and this is the 1920s, people didn't really know what people were doing in India or in these lineages. And now we know more, of course, but he thought that the Western consciousness was trained, was it's sort of like plants that grow in Africa versus plants that grow in Europe. They're going to bloom in different ways and they need different nourishment. So the Western person doesn't need 8 hours of meditation. In fact, he just required our Sufi community to meditate for 30 minutes a day, just saying God's name. It could be any name of God. And for 15 minutes as well to meditate on an icon of any master's face.
Yeah.
So we all do that. But typically in the East, he would stress a lot more meditation, vegetarianism. Although even then he was pushing the boundaries there and he's breaking down caste boundaries and so forth. So, but he did say that there was a difference in consciousness in the West versus the East at that time. This is the 20th century that would lead to a mixing. In fact, one of his last acts in 1962, one of his last acts was to have what he called the East-West gathering. He gathered all of his disciples from both hemispheres as a way to acknowledge that this work, it was being done and being finished in a certain way, and that we were moving into a new world of convergence and mutual enrichment, you could say.
I kind of like that spitball little story there, you know, because I think sometimes we think of the practice of mysticism as something we do, but the practice is really, it's like a technology of the spirit. It's really kind of honing the spirit or training the mind to come to those deeper levels of insight or consciousness so that we exist in a new way. You know, mysticism is not about doing, it's about being, right?
So that's right. That's
how we're going about, how we're living in, you know, on a deeper level in this world. And so, you know, I could see the difference, say, between, say, somewhere in India, you know, the Sufi of India and the Sufi of, you know, New Jersey, in the sense that, you know, the U.S. is so pragmatically oriented, you know, we're constantly want to do things. So, you know, sort of this idea of like, if I practice this mysticism, I could become a mystic. You know, you can get a degree in mysticism, like the M.M.
Right. Yeah.
instead of like the, it's a constant, and I think, you know, this is maybe what you're talking about, is that constant focusing of the mind on these higher levels of consciousness or higher levels of reality.
Yeah.
And constantly working or disciplining, you might say, those forces within us that want to pull us away from those higher levels of reality. And that's the inner journey, so to speak, or the inner challenge that I think all mystical traditions in some way deal with.
Yeah, that's true. And Meher Baba stressed love, obedience, and surrender, and love being sort of the beginning, actually, that you love God. And maybe if you have a teacher, you love that guru, you love God through that guru, or that guru actually is not even coming in between you and God. It's sort of an embodiment of the friend. And that in terms of obeying the master, that's sort of your, it could be doing anything. I mean, there's so many stories Meher Baba would tell about obeying the master, and it could be things that were really like would be paradoxical to the mind. The mind would be like, I don't want to do that. Like when Murshida, my teacher, asked me to become an academic to get a PhD, that to me, my mind didn't understand that because I'm an artist. You know, my identification with being, my attachment to being an artist didn't allow me to open to other possibilities. But to do that which the master says, I'm actually just behind me, there's a quote from Hafiz. This is what's Meher Baba's favorite quote. He says, being about what you hear from the master, never say it is wrong. Because, my dear, the fault lies in your own incapacity to understand him. These are three. Actually, let me read the other two because they're also related. Befitting a fortunate slave, carry out every command of the master without any question of why and what. I am a slave of a master who has released me from ignorance. Whatever my master does is of the highest benefit to all concerned. So this is something he quoted from Hafiz, who's a Sufi master.
Yeah, I really like that. But I think, you know, we have to, the person who can really live in that or be attentive to what the master is saying has to have, you might say, the inner soil of the heart prepared to receive, in our Christian language, the word of God, you know, or the seed.
That's right.
And thinking like two things. One, I think of the story from the Desert Fathers, you know, the young monk who goes to the old abbot. He says, you know, Father, I've done everything. I pray three times a day or five times a day, and I fast and I do good works. You know, how can I become truly holy? And the old monk says, when you come back next year, you know, and he comes away all, you know, disappointed. And
right.
He says, well, I'll come back following years. He says, well, I've done the same thing, and I've done it even more now. I fasted more. And, you know, then goes to the monk. Monk says, you're not ready, you know, so come back in 3 years. And this is the thing. It's like the monastic tradition is not time dependent, right? There's an eternal quality that, like, it's about preparedness. It's about a readiness. It's about kind of shaping our lives to be godly. And so finally, this young monk, like, you know, he's probably like an older man by now, and he goes to the old guy and he says, okay, I've done everything. What should I do? And the old monk stands up and he stretches out in his arms and he says, why not be turned into fire? You know?
Why not? Yeah. Yeah. That's
why not be totally consumed? You know? And that's it. Like, our American culture, I think, wants something like mysticism or wants the mystical past, but I'm not sure we're really ready to be turned into fire. You know, we're not really, we're consumers, but we don't want to be consumed.
Consumed, yeah.
And therefore, I think that kind of willingness to be consumed goes to the Benedictine rule, which is the opening of that rule is bend your ear and listen, right? Listen, you know. And that listening obedience is to listen attentively. And that's where I think, you know, the point you just read, that when we talk about the
Abadir.
Yes. In other words, right, you know, what is the master saying? Then there's a preparedness, there's a readiness to hear, a receptivity. Jesus gets at the same thing, right? It's about the soil, the rocky soil, and the soil, you know, which can receive that seed into it and yield a rich harvest. And, you know, I wonder in our own culture, which is so fast-paced and fragmented and, you know, consumer-driven, information-driven, like, how do you, in your own Sufi life, how do you bring these points into the practice of your own life? How do you remain in that soil, that rich soil, to listen?
What drew me to this community actually was I was looking after seminary, after discerning priesthood with the Congregation of Holy Cross. I felt so called to being an artist and an intentional community. And I knew that those two things were going to be important for my practice going forward, no matter what. And so when I heard about this Sufi community, it was a community, first of all, and that's what drew me. When I think most of my Sufi companions, they would say, they did not want community. They're independent Americans, and they didn't want sort of living in close proximity with other people the way this is set up. The pattern of life is very intense. And though it's traditional in the sense that all Sufi communities, you always go and live with the teacher, you live with the master, because that's the real practice, is that you are surrendering to this life and you're surrendering to this pattern of life that the master is living silently, really, and through words and teachings, but mainly silently. You're sort of living, seeing this example of how to live a life.
Do you have a master where you are?
That's right. Yeah. Our Murshid, we call her, well, our master, our Murshid, just passed away April 22nd.
Oh.
And she was our Murshid for the last since 2001. And so we had an investiture. She had named her successor, a young gentleman who is now our Murshid. And so we had his investiture in May 21st, and then the celebration of her interment the next day. So we're sort of in transition at the moment in terms of having a master. But Mayor Baba set it up that we would have a master one after the other for hundreds of years.
Now, just so you know, for our listeners, you're married. Is that right?
That's right.
Your wife and yourself both live in this intentional Sufi community.
That's correct.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome. And do you consider yourself Sufi or Christian Sufi? Are you Catholic? Or where are you on this religious identity?
Yeah, it's fluid. I'm enjoying this fluidity about identity now because I've always felt fluid anyway. But in terms of my religious interest, I'm definitely Catholic. I'm definitely a Sufi.
Oh, I love that.
I also feel I'm definitely a follower of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo. And so if I'm with my Sri Aurobindo community folks, I might bring in my Catholic and Sufi perspectives, but it's really, I kind of focus on the Mother and Sri Aurobindo. But I mean, I would say it all comes from, I'm grounded probably most in Sufism. Like if I was going to sort of say, where is my source and my kind of where I'm coming from, and that helps me pull it all together, I would say Sufism reoriented in Mayor Baba.
Yeah, that's great. What nourishes your soul, so to speak.
This concludes the first part of Ilya's conversation with Patrick Baldio. Listen next week when Ilya asks Patrick what or who is God, and more about the wisdom of Patrick's teacher, Mayor Baba. If you're interested in the work of Teilhard de Chardin and process thought more generally, consider joining us, either online or in person, for a special academic conference at Villanova University on Alfred North Whitehead and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. With a notable speaking docket including Ilya Delio, Catherine Keller, Andrew Davis, and many more, we explore the many convergences, divergences, and integrations between these two influential thinkers. For more information, visit christogenesis.org or find the Center for Process Studies on the web. We hope to see you there. Thanks to our partners at the Fetzer Institute and our team at the Center for Christogenesis. I'm Robert Nicastro. Thanks for listening.